I want to see the team have the kind of fight that they had in 2016, even if we shock the world. Shock the world!
They're playing a Mexican team in the next round.
That's what I was about to say.
Howard and forward, Jack Price in goal.
And the Colorado Rapids, the team from the Rockies, have scaled their own mountain tonight. They are MLS Cup winners.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to another episode of Holding the High Line with Rabbi and Red. We are recording this on the evening of Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018. Rabbi Mark Goodman, how are you?
Good. Just got back from Pittsburgh, and it was a good trip. And I'll share this really quickly. I love that I couldn't be at the USL game today. That they had because we came back yesterday. So today is Wednesday. They played an Open Cup game against FC Cincinnati, Fußball Cincinnati, and they lost 3-1. But so we left yesterday, and before I left, I stopped off and I wanted to go get a scarf, but I couldn't. But they don't have like store hours, you know, like a proper club, because they're a little club. So I tweeted out like, how do I go get a scarf? And like one supporter tweeted at me, I'll give you mine. And the holder of the Pittsburgh Riverhounds Twitter account said, hey, this is so-and-so in the media department. Come on over to stadium. I'll open up the team store for you. So I came. I called on him. The guy came down. He opened up the team store. He sold me a teddy bear for my kids and a scarf. And away I went. And I've got my Riverhounds Unleashed scarf, you know, around my neck as we speak. So it's great, especially since because we're selling our house, all my other scarves are down. So me and Matt are recording in the soccer basement, which has nothing in it except a TV and a PlayStation. Anyhow, that's what's going on with me. Matt, what's going on with you? Matt is going to miss this week's Rapids game.
I am.
But for a really good reason. Matt, tell us why.
One of my very good friends, I would dare say the St. Louis FC equivalent of at Rapids Rabbi on Twitter, Matt Bird, you might know him more affectionately at Lulican Bird, will be in town in Colorado Springs this weekend as St. Louis FC attend their only match at Fortress Sand Creek against the Colorado Springs Switchbacks FC. When Richard Terry and I first met Mark, we were talking and I was aware of him doing, you know, Flacco Goss and everything, and he was mentioning a couple people who he had on his like American soccer lower division I want to meet this person bucket list. And so I had mentioned that I did graduate school in St. Louis, and he said, oh, so you must know like Matt Bird and yada yada. And I'm like, you're listing off a whole bunch of people who I have my own phone numbers to, I have ridden buses with them and such. It's like, yeah, like if you want me to introduce you to Matt Bird, like I can introduce you to Matt Bird. So Richard texts me, probably Richard Terry, a besotted member of C38, I would classify him as.
So besotted.
Texted me a couple weeks ago saying, hey, St. Louis FC's going to be in town. I found out Matt Bird's taking the camper and his little kid Ewan, who I don't believe I've actually met. I think he's 7 or 8 now, will be in town. So we will be driving down. There will be another member, another British expat. Matt Bird is a Mancunian. He's a Manchester United fan by birth, not one of the plastic ones.
Oh, he's a Brit.
Yes. So we'll be in town. Jose Bueno will be joining us to talk about Man U. But then another Englishman will also be joining us, who just so happens, Mark, to be a Fulham supporter. And prior to the Switchbacks playing, obviously listeners will be aware that the Champions League final will be taking place between Liverpool FC and Real Madrid, potentially going for the first ever three-peat in the history of Champions League. But 2 hours before that, at Wembley Stadium, in the English Premier League promotion playoff, it will be Fulham Football Club taking on Aston Villa. Winner take all. Winner gets into the Premier League. The loser has to stay in the Championship next year.
So there's the Championship and the Champions League, and they happen on the. Are they on the same day?
They are on the same day. It'll be 10 a.m. Mountain Time at Wembley Stadium, and then I guess however you pronounce the Kiev Stadium will be noon proper on Saturday for the Mountain Time Zone for Champions League final, and then of course the Switchbacks, much like the Rapids, prefer to have Saturday night games. So I believe it'll be a 7 or 7:30 kickoff at Fortress Sand Creek in Colorado Springs.
People are going to wonder why I'm running out of synagogue like 15 minutes before the service ends on Saturday. Like, oh, nothing. I just had a thing. Bye-bye. You know, like, So, I don't know. And the reality, though, of course, is that the Champions League final is never that good. It's always a little bit disappointing.
It's a very traditional final in the sense that it's cagey. The teams take a while to figure each other out. It's not the prettiest football.
Last year wasn't. Last year, you know, because Real Madrid got onto the front foot early-ish, right? And then they kind of... Did that game end 3-1 or something like that? Or I feel like last year...
They're all bleeding together with
that's
me.
That's the thing.
I can't, like,
especially when Real Madrid is in all of them.
Yeah, like I'm thoroughly expecting Real Madrid to win. I would say that Mo Salah is going to have to outdo Ronaldo on the day for Liverpool to even have a chance.
And that's the other interesting thing with a final like that, which is you've got these ridiculously insane Ballon d'Or global superstars in the most important match of the whole year for them.
And the not this year.
Well, maybe. Depends. It depends. Because you're already assuming, by what you just said, you're already assuming that either Ronaldo or Salah will be in the final of the World Cup. Although, you know, anyways, argument.
Okay, I wouldn't say either of them are going to be in the final.
I don't think so either, which is why I don't think... I think this game is probably the biggest game of the year for them. And the assumption becomes... It's almost like the LeBron parallel is an obvious one, which is that, you know, the greats in the NBA have always elevated their game in the most important games. You know, those moments where Michael Jordan with 6 seconds on the clock nails the clutch jumper to, like, win game 7. And I feel like, you could tell me you disagree, but I feel like soccer's not quite like that. That, like, because there's 11 guys on the field, because form naturally dips and rises a little bit from game to game, I think a little bit more than in the NBA, it's unlikely that Mo Salah or Cristiano are going to take over this game and be the guy. It could happen. I mean, Ronaldo was probably the guy last year. But, you know, somebody else.
I think they'll both be the focal points of their own attacks. If you told me that either one or both of them were not going to have their best game of the year, you know, I thought Mo Salah, you know, was excellent in his two games against Roma, for example. Ronaldo's obviously had a number of key games. If you told me neither of them are going to have their best game on Saturday, I wouldn't be completely surprised, Mark. You know, I thought Lionel Messi was the best player in the World Cup final in 2014, and because Sergio Ramos and Higuain can't finish, you know, we're talking about Germany potentially going for, right, you know, a repeat rather than can Lionel Messi cement himself above Maradona at this point. Whereas I would say most Argentine soccer football fans are talking about him in the context of can he catch up to Maradona's legacy.
Right. 4 years ago, Müller was the guy you were most looking forward to doing something for Germany. And the hero of that game was Mario Götze. So, yeah. By the way, the only reason to root for Germany in the World Cup is just because it's so much fun pronouncing German names, you know? The fact that there's an umlaut over the O, and then there's a W and a D and an S, but you pronounce the name Hubbardus, is all just a freaking mystery to me. I don't understand how that happens. It leads into a whole other story about how I once mispronounced Goethe in college, but that's not that interesting for listeners. So, all right, we should move on and talk about local soccer, other than the Switchbacks. Who is the local team? I haven't noticed them lately. They haven't put any points up on the board. So
that group would be the Colorado Rapids, Mark.
Right.
Need I remind you that we are the official independent analytical Colorado Rapids podcast on the interwebs.
And I think at this point I've written over 500 articles, mostly on the Colorado Rapids. So you would think that I would know that.
This calendar year I will crack 1,000 articles written for Last Word on Soccer. Which
is but yours
crazy.
Are short and they're not that interesting. So.
Speaking of other games...
Writer banter!
Speaking of other games that were disappointing and not that interesting from one standpoint, Mark, Colorado Rapids lost their fifth game in a row on Saturday at a rainy and waterlogged Yankee Stadium. New York City FC getting a 4-0 victory. David Villa scores in the 22nd minute off of some great passing from Maxi Morales and Yangel Herrera in the 22nd minute off of a clearance... back pass, something from Tim Howard straight to another player.
Oh my god.
Ronald Matarina cleans up a header off of a rebound off of some great passing from NYCFC in the 49th minute. Maxi Morales finishes off a play when the Rapids defense decide to stop playing because they're expecting a whistle and don't expect a whistle in the 56th minute. And then David Villa with some great passing from Rodney Wallace and Maxi Morales walk through the Rapids middle six, I will call them, the three center mids and the three center backs like their Swiss cheese to complete his brace on David Villa, no less, in the 74th minute mark. The citizens get out of there out of Dodge, and the Rapids have now dropped five straight, and it's almost foreboding that Hudson was trying to explain away or spin their losses after the New York Red Bulls game, saying that they've been in every single game. You know, it's been at worst.
Which
one
is
goal
not
at
true.
Halftime.
Which is not true. They have not been in every game, but we'll get to that.
In the context of a close scoreline and then having opportunities in the last 15
minutes. Of course.
Minutes. Okay, that's his spin, and one of his main arguments was normally when you're on this bad of a stretch, when you have all these injuries, you have one of those games where you get hammered. You know, you think about think about Crystal Palace going to Liverpool and getting destroyed by Liverpool, for example. You would think about, you know, New York, you think about somebody going to Atlanta, getting a red card in the first half, and losing 4 or 5 nil.
You think about Brazil-Germany a few years ago.
And so Hudson argued last week saying that, oh, this hadn't happened, we've been in every game. Mark, from the first whistle, the Colorado Rapids were not in this game.
No.
Getting to our
possession, possession was a series of blue lines on the MLS website. The Rapids controlled, in 5-minute clips of possession, they were almost even in two of the 5-minute blocks. The other 80 minutes, New York City. Now, possession isn't everything, but if you can't string together 4 passes, then you don't have a counterattack. So, anyways, go on, Matt.
Okay, so in any case, Mark, I guess drawing off of that, let's try and be positive to start. What was your good thing from this fifth straight loss?
There were no good things. Back to you, Matt.
Okay, so here's what I have written. Here's what I have written down on my note sheet, Mark. Listeners, we are very professional and we try to plan these things out, so we do have notes. I have Edgar Castillo's shot off the post in garbage time, question mark.
I don't remember that. I've trusted it happened, but I don't remember it.
Okay, I have Michael Zira getting his first start and not being the worst player on the field.
That was good. And actually, if you look at his stats, his passing numbers were good. Now, Michael Zira is always tidy with short passes. But, you know, to play...
Make a tackle, win the ball, get to Sam Groen,
and I'm a huge Michael Zira fan for a lot of reasons. But he is exactly what he is, which is he is a great 75th minute D-mid sub, but he's not Jack Price, and not having Jack Price was really the most hurtful thing out there. So I wouldn't call it a good thing that Michael Azira started, just because it was mostly a bad thing we didn't have Jack Price.
And then on my third bullet, I have ... third mark. So yeah, that is the it for the good things I have. Okay,
I love
Mark,
that you even tried to have a good thing out of this game. Get
okay.
This thing. I'll give you a good thing, right? The last time we went to Yankee Stadium and played NYCFC, we lost 5-1. We were a total train wreck from beginning to end. This game was only a modest train wreck. This was a bad game where we were losing for much of it. But it wasn't like as bad as when we got absolutely curb stomped against New York City FC in their first season.
So, assuming a linear progression, in about a decade, the Rapids should be able to go there and get a gritty, completely
nil-nil
uninspiring,
yeah,
completely ugly 0-0 draw. So 2028.
Pablo will be our coach again.
2028, folks. Colorado Rapids at Yankee Stadium. 0-0 draw whenever that happens. Okay, Mark, I have a lot of bad things here. What were your bad things from this game?
Nana Boateng at right back is really unconvincing. It's very difficult. And then this is a second bad thing, but it's very difficult that the Rapids shift their formation when they fall behind. They essentially continue in a theoretical 5-3-2 formation, but they pull one of the back five out and push them up, meaning everybody kind of slides over, and then you're asking Nana Boateng, who's really a midfielder. I mean, he really, really is. He plays the right back position when he's a wing back, and he's a get forward kind of offensive wing back. But when you slot him in, you basically say, Nana, stay home and be the defensive right back that Eric Miller was, bad things happen. So Nana Boateng at right back was not good. Enzo Martinez had a really bad game, and I hate saying that because everybody knows that me and Matt are on the Enzo Martinez train, but he's passed at a 57% clip.
That's terrible.
It was awful.
Mid.
Basically, every time he got the ball, they put a little pressure on him and he coughed it up, or he made a questionable pass. It was not good. Edgar Castillo was the same. Sam Nicholson was fairly ineffective, doing the same kinds of things he'd been doing in previous weeks, kind of, you know, playing 1-2s off of Castillo on the left. The whole back three was a full-blown train wreck. Like, nothing worked in the back three. There were plays where they looked like traffic cones. There were plays where they stepped when they should have dropped. There were plays when one of them moved up and took the line out of sync so that there was an obvious pass behind and around. And that's exactly what
that pass for Maxi Morales that was that they one I was almost scored of. In the like 28 seconds in.
That's right.
Because Danny Wilson was pressing up to try and take away right. the space from David Villa.
The back three either need to hold the line, or one of them, or all of them need to step either to create the offside trap or to put pressure on the guy with the ball. And you can't do
if you break that line, yeah. then you know the chain is only as strong as the weakest link of the train. And by Danny Wilson, whoever's yeah. stepping up, you have a broken link in the chain.
And the last
you have
thing,
no chain, Mark.
The last thing I'll say, and not to, I hope I didn't suck up all the oxygen and give you very little to talk about, but like, and Tim Howard was bad. I mean, he's guilty of the first goal 110% by making a bad pass. And then I don't know, and I think we both have seen this both on Twitter. And in the games ourselves, which is like, I don't know when Tim Howard freezes as the ball goes slotting by him and he just stands there like a statue, if that's because he is completely beaten and there's nothing any goalkeeper could do and he's smart enough to know that, or he's a little bit out of position and he would have had a play at it had he not been so out of position, or he's beyond over the hill and he just can't dive anymore. Right, I don't know which one of them it is. It for me, I generally think it's the first one. Like, if the ball's behind Tim, he's not going to dive at it, so he can say I made a dive at it. But I don't really know anymore, man. I don't like. I watch him stand there as we get flambéed, and I don't understand whether he's just whiffing on it or not. I don't know.
I don't know either on that, Mark. That's timely that you have that question. I was having a conversation with one of my good hockey friends. Tonight we're currently going on the third period of Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals just ended. And I was talking about some of my other favorite goalkeepers, and I have a friend who's a winger from college who lives in Texas now. And anytime he wants sort of a goalkeeper perspective, because I was a goalie playing hockey, he'll ask that question. I don't know enough about goalkeeping in soccer, because obviously, you know, the padding's very different, and the dimensions of, you know, of surface area that a hockey goalie takes up to surface area of the net are very different. I do remember on the replay, I want to say it was David Villa's second goal. He wrong-footed Howard, and Howard was, I guess, in the short left infield there, and he didn't have footing. He lost his footing, like there was a divot
yeah.
of grass. So I give him a pass on that one, at least in the context of not diving for the ball. On the second goal, the Yangel Herrera, who am I thinking, who headed the ball? Yeah, Ronald Matarrita, he already made the first save, and I think you can, from a blame pie perspective,
oh, yeah.
I think somebody else should have gathered up the rebound. I would retweet your question in the context of the third goal.
I mean, I'll say that, like, if Tim Howard has a good performance or even a great performance, we lose 2-0, so who cares?
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the bigger piece, but I definitely, when people are calling for Tim Howard's head on a pike, I can't defend the guy, you know? It's hard to defend him and say, like, no, he's really been good, because there's, you know, I eventually, in a week or two, I will start pulling numbers, and once you get past, like, 8, 10, 12 games, you can start looking at goalie numbers and saying they mean something in terms of expected goals and so on. But I don't know that anybody that knows anything about soccer at this point has said, No, Tim Howard's doing just fine. Like, the conventional wisdom is pretty much that Tim Howard is performing below average as a goalkeeper,
yes.
and that's disappointing.
Now, if, you know, say the Rapids play the Sounders, for example, and Casey Keller on the broadcast brings up a couple little points from a goalkeeper's perspective.
I was hoping you were going to say Casey Keller plays against Tim Howard, who would be better, but that's a good question.
I don't have any answer to that. So, you know, I can't speak to that, Mark. I think the one thing that I will say, I'd say in the last 18 months, I'd say, at least from a visual perspective, not looking at the stats, I'd say Howard's been extremely inconsistent. I don't have a clear answer as to whether or not he's over the hill, but, you know, he goes out against Sporting Kansas City, and if he doesn't make those 7 saves or whatever you have, the Rapids lose that game, and they lose it before stoppage time, when, or they, you know, they lose that game rather than Sporting Kansas City tying it up in stoppage time. You know, he was the only thing that kept, that last game at RSL last season remotely respectable. In terms of scoreline, I think he stopped a PK, and then I want to say it was Yerimov Sisson ultimately getting the goal to, you know, ultimately put the dagger in and win RSL the Rocky Mountain Cup. So for all of these performances where fans might say, well, Howard, why haven't you dove into the ball and this, that, and the other thing, you know, he comes out and has another game where he makes one key world-class Tim Howard against Belgium in Brazil save. So I don't know whether or not he's over the hill.
He had that save and the first shot in the game that you mentioned.
Yes.
He had a kick save to his right that was he was positioning was good.
There was pain for inside the far post.
Right.
So he has great moments and he has bad moments.
Yeah.
I don't know that either of us know enough technically about the goalkeeping position in terms of judging his frustration at times or his decision not to dive for balls or being mishit on that. Okay, Mark.
And like I said, as a team, you know, if Tim Howard was an average or above, turned in an average or an above average goalkeeper performance in every single game this season, I don't know if we take any more points. Maybe we take one.
Maybe a loss becomes a draw.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
Draw
maybe two
win.
Draws become, maybe two losses become draws, and that's the difference if Tim Howard is doing better. We need a performance, we need better performance at 11 different spots to really be doing. To pull out of this five-loss tailspin.
I would include the three substitutes in that, Mark. I would say all 14 players who saw the field on Saturday fundamentally not good enough, and I'd say you amp everybody up by 10%, and that's probably still not good enough. You needed a perfect individual and collective performance, especially defensively, to get a result against New York City FC. You didn't get that, and I thought the scoreline was very much reflective of the difference in where the two teams are right now.
And I'll add my big thing, I guess, to close out the discussion about NYCFC, which is the other big piece that is complicated, is that the Rapids are struggling with game states from the beginning of season to the end. At the beginning of the season was the opposite problem that we've been having from the last couple of games. At the beginning of the season it was
how do you end games?
We go up one goal or we have a draw or we go up two goals and we can't close out, right? So the game state is we become defensive, we become we let the other team have the ball, and then we blow it. Now it's the opposite problem, which is we fall behind 1-0, and the coach institutes some sort of changes, and they make us fall behind 2-0 and then 3-0, right? And that's where we were this game, which we'll talk more about. But like our game state situations right now are really terrible, that we fall behind. And we dig ourselves into bigger holes because our tactical adjustments actually make things worse rather than
better. Yeah, Jose Mourinho had a really good interview. I want to say it was BBC or something, and there was a tactical question. He said, you have to treat games or halves in thirds. So if we're Manchester United and we're going into Manchester City, and you know, if they beat us, then they win the league, so to speak. Okay, there is an approach to the first 15 minutes when they're going to have energy in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be approach to the next 15 minutes when they adjust and we need to adjust. There's an approach to us getting into our game in the opening 15 minutes. So in that sense, the game is broken up into six segments of 15 minutes. And at this point, it was an absolute mess from the Rapids. At that point, Mark, I'll show you what do I have written down for big thing?
Big thing. Hudson's responsibility, which is a lot like what I said.
I was at training on Tuesday, and I asked Hudson about his thoughts on the game, and he said, I don't want to call it putting lambs to the slaughter, but he took borderline full responsibility for the performance on Saturday, Mark. You know, you saw, we talked about how the playing surface, in particular the half in which Edgar Castillo was going to be playing basically first base to shortstop in terms of on that field, and that limiting him offensively. And that just so happened to be in the first half when the Rapids were, you know, not playing so well and New York City FC was able to find themselves in the game. The Rapids needed to be able to adjust to this game, and then you combine the fact that you have different surfaces, a small pitch, one that New York City FC has sort of perfected under Patrick Vieira in terms of how to play it, and need to be able to adjust. The Rapids, you know, they made three substitutions this one. They brought in some attacking players in order to try and change things up. But it seemed to me that either for the 90 minutes, at either at any given point, there was no plan, or the plan was we're going to continue to play out of the back. When you saw on the first goal that playing out of the back essentially wasn't a possibility, there was no adjustment period whatsoever. And that's on Hudson in terms of thinking that we can go in there and play like that, seeing the rainy surface, seeing that, you know, you have a slow pass, you know, from Declan Wynn out to, Nana Boateng in space, and just by it having to go on the surface, it slows down. Immediately, there needed to be an adjustment. And look, maybe it's not pretty. Let's get it out to the wings. Let's have Dominic Baggi and Joe Mason run all day, and let's just root one them to death and hope that it hurts. That's at least something that's going to work. You can't play out of the back with the players that this team had, with the level of performance that they had against New York City FC and had a result, Mark. You know, a lot of people on Twitter are flaming the players. I think the players deserve a lot of blame. Hudson set this team up to fail from the first minute, and from what I can tell, at least there was no change in the players executing it, which means either Hudson did a poor job of planning it, or he did a horrible job preparing the players to need to adjust. The adjustments for this team in general have been poor, and this team on so many levels was set up to fail, and I would include the individuals getting checks from the Colorado Rapids on the bench.
Yep.
Moving on, Mark, that things are getting any easier. The Colorado Rapids will play this Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park against the Portland Timbers. The Rapids are currently 10-34 through the 2018 MLS season, Mark. If my math is correct, that reduces to 5/17. Their opponents, the Portland Timbers, have also played 10 games. The Timbers are tied for third in the Western Conference with 17 points. The Rapids are currently tied for last if you go by games played. The Sounders have 8 points in the Western Conference, but have one fewer games played. Mark, the Timbers had a terrible start to the regular season, albeit with 5 on the road. They went winless, 0-3-2. Since then, they have won 5 in a row, 4 of those being at home. Diego Valeri has figured out his form. Giovanni Savarese and Liam Ridgewell, kissed and made up in whatever issue that they were having with him not traveling with the team. He promptly got hurt and right now is doubtful for this coming game this Saturday. He got hurt in the first half against Los Angeles Football Club. Fernando Audi continues to look dangerous. Sebastian Blanco, who scored a goal against the Rapids at Dick's Sporting Goods Park last year, continues to look dangerous. And who am I thinking of? Their other forward. Ama something.
Oh, the guy who had the really nice goal.
Yes.
This week, Armenteros. Yes.
Armenteros is also looking very dangerous.
When you said that, all I could think of was Omarosa, the woman who worked in the White House for about hot minute.
And I realized that's not right,
She lasted 3 Scaramucci's, I think, in the White House.
Samuel Armenteros scored. So the Portland Timbers are really good, but they also haven't been that great on the road, Mark. What do you make of the Timbers, and what the heck do the Rapids need to do to end this losing streak against a really good team?
Well, the hopeful thing is that Portland is on a 5-game win streak. The Rapids are on a 5-game losing streak. The thing that's important to remember is that Portland played 4 of those games at home, so that's very helpful. Granted, they beat good teams. They beat New York City 3-0, they beat Seattle 1-0, and they beat LAFC 2-1. So those are impressive victories. But they also just squeaked by San Jose. I think that goal that they scored on May 6th was a last seconder.
That was Diego Valeri.
That was
Valeri 88th minute.
Right. Yeah, that was
and
an awesome free
San Jose game. Was controlling the game, but the Quakes can't finish right now. So
right,
Goonie's gonna Goonie.
Right, on the flip side of that, Portland has lost 3 games on the road, and overall they have in 6. Games away, they have 5 points. So they're bad on the road, and I was trying to look up how they do at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, because I remember that it seems like they lose at DSGP all the time. I'll try and find that while you kind of put together your thoughts. But the thing that's hopeful is that Portland is not great on the road, like most teams. But particularly Portland, for the last 2 seasons, isn't good on the road, and we have the additional thing of altitude. The other piece that I was going to mention that you mentioned, you know, Fernando Audi is running into form. He's starting to come around, despite the fact that at the off season of MLS, the assumption was that Audi was either going to be sold or that he was just spending the beginnings of the season either begrudgingly playing for this
team. He was trying to Kyle Lahren.
Right? Or that he was going to perform decently just so that he could audition for another team. That, like, Adi's not really... But it seems like, I don't know, there have been no ripples about whether he really wants out or anything like that. And it doesn't sound like there have been many rumors about, you know, transfer interest around the world. It hurts that he hasn't been particularly, you know, dominant for the last part of last year or the beginning of this year, that nobody's going to, like, say, oh, you know, he's so impressive, let's take him. But so that's interesting to me. And then Sebastian Blanco is doing a little bit better on the wing. Their fullbacks are always Vitas on one side and Estrella on the other.
This year it's been Valentin on the left and Alves Powell on the right.
Yeah, Powell.
And neither have looked that
convincing. Has Vitas been out hurt, or is he just been...
I'm not sure. I haven't seen Vitas in the starting 11.
It's just always fun to have him on there because his name is so hard to say. Yes. So some people try and really show off by saying Vitautas Andraškevičius, which I probably got wrong, but at least I tried. So, I mean, they're a talented team, but they tend to kind of struggle on the road, and Savarese struggled at the beginning. You know, I guess I'll say one last thing, which is the key for them is always Diego Chará. If he is in his element and riding that line, that fine line where he's committing physical plays and regular fouls, then he's an effective player. If he draws an early yellow and he's just swinging elbows left, right, and center, then he's fairly useless to them. He becomes a liability and not an asset. And that's Chará to a T. I mean, he is basically, you know, you can like put him down for a yellow card almost every night.
Yeah.
If he can avoid that and still be effective, then, or if he can hold off, if that yellow card for him comes in the 75th instead of the 5th, he becomes an extremely dangerous weapon. He just kills games. And it also has to do with whether they're going to play him as the lone defensive mid or whether they're going to play somebody else alongside him. So anyways, those are my thoughts. Matt, your take on Portland coming in.
This is a really interesting tactical matchup. I think this is other than Toronto FC with what Greg Vanney's done with the 3-5-2, and briefly when Chalice, if you remember him, Mark, was with Chivas USA for about 2 months. We haven't really had a team that's committed to the 3-5-2 in the way that Hudson and the Rapids are in 2018. And Giovanni Savarese is pulling out the Christmas tree formation, if you remember that, what they called it in one of the old FIFA versions, the 4-3-2-1 with kind of a 6 and 2 8s in the midfield, and then two central attacking midfielders, and then your lone number 9 up top, with the fullbacks being relatively conservative. In that sense, you can easily commit 6 players to the attack and then also have 7 field players defensively. A lot of times, you know, we've talked about the 3-5-2 running into a different formation. We talked about it in the context of CONCACAF Champions League and what happens when you have a 3-5-2 play another 3-5-2. I don't really know what happens when a 3-5-2 runs into a Christmas tree formation, Mark. You've got the thing that simplifies it from a center mid standpoint, and I've written and tweeted about this a whole bunch the last couple of weeks and talked about on the pod about trying to figure out what the heck the 3-man midfield is. In the context of this, it seems pretty simple. Sebastian Blanco is going to be a roamer, so he's going to be all over the field, so you pick him up based on the space that he takes. Fernando Adi is going to be your center mid. You lock him into whoever that central center back is, probably Danny Wilson, if precedent is able to indicate anything. Then, at this point, Diego Valeri is going to be your central, you know, number 10-ish style player. That's Jack Price's responsibility. And then it's basically, okay, we know Diego Chara is not going to get forward, so whoever's on Andy Polo's side picks up that, and whoever's on Padilla's side picks up him. In the context of every other formation we've seen, and I got into it with Jason Longshore, who's the radio commentator for Atlanta United FC, in the context of how very quickly in the game on Saturday, New York City FC switched to a 3-4-3 in order to overload the Rapids midfield, knowing that the fullbacks weren't going to cut inside. They have a numbers advantage, and on both sides of the ball, either New York City FC pressing Colorado in possession or New York City overloading the Rapids in possession. By switching that up and having the domination in the midfield, you push up the point of confrontation, and the other team has to adjust to that. This, I don't want to say that it's going to be easier necessarily, but it's going to be simpler in that the assignments are going to be relatively straightforward. If Enzo Martinez is your right center midfielder, then his defensive job is going to be to pick up Andy Polo. We know what Jack Price is going to do. Everything else is very straightforward. We know the fullbacks aren't going to get involved, so there's no – Portland's not going to pull any punches or isn't going to adjust anything in the way that, Jesse Marsh is very nuanced tactically and the way Patrick Vieira is very nuanced tactically.
Which begs the question of whether Anthony Hudson is going to adjust something tactically, because we haven't seen formation adjustments, which is fine. That's his
MO.
Yeah, that's his way of doing things. But we have seen small in-game tactical changes, typically using the center backs to come up in the attack when you want to really push for a goal. But we are still waiting to see a massive tactical shift that's really obvious from Coach Hudson. So
yes,
I was going to answer my earlier point, which is how did the Timbers do at Dick's Sporting Goods Park? The answer is Colorado has at DSGP. Colorado has won 6 games. Portland has won 1 game, and there have been 3 ties, with the Rapids putting in 19 goals and the Timbers having only 8. So it's true, the Rapids are typically the better team at Dick's Sporting Goods Park.
Can I ask when that win occurred for the Timbers?
That was the next thing I was going to look up, which is the only time Portland won at Colorado. Yeah, it's far enough back that I don't know when it was. So it was,
Are we talking pre-Pareja then, potentially?
Yeah, I don't know. The last 5 games,
it hasn't been in the last 2 years then.
Yeah, the last 5 games it's been.
Last 3 years.
The last 5 games it's been the home team winning every single time. Portland beat Colorado at Portland. Colorado beat Portland at home last year. And same in 2016. So
The other thing we're potentially looking at here, Mark, is some familiarity. Marco Cummings wrote a great article for Pro Soccer USA that I would encourage you to check out about the boyhood friendship between Yannick Bolli and Laris Mabiala.
Oh yeah, that was a good article.
Yes, so that's going to be interesting because Mabiala, I assume with Virgil out, is going to be the primary center back organizing things. Potentially Yannick Bolli could be getting his second start with the Colorado Rapids, so you've got some familiarity, particularly in two positions where they're going to be going up against each other directly. And while Jeff Atanello has been starting for the Timbers, should Jake Leeson feature, then obviously Anthony Hudson is going to be very familiar with him and his strengths and weaknesses, and I assume he will be relaying that scouting report to Connor Casey to then give it to the forwards in terms of understanding Jake Leeson's strengths and weaknesses based on their mutual time together with the New Zealand national team. So I think I wouldn't say that this game is going to be easier, certainly, but I think it's going to simplify some things tactically that could be to the advantage of the Rapids, I think there's going to be some familiarity which could benefit them as well.
I think it'll be close. I don't think Portland doesn't tend to beat the crud out of teams. You know, they tend to play a little bit tight, although there have been a lot more high-scoring games with them this season than in previous seasons. So I think whatever it is, it'll probably be close, and it won't be close in that SKC over Rapids 1-0, which wasn't really a close game. That was SKC dominating the Rapids, getting a gazillion chances they didn't convert, whereas the Rapids were just kind of creaking along. I think this could be a pretty straightforward throwback to the beginning of the season when we actually looked pretty decent. So we'll be in this one. I can't tell you whether we're going to win it or not, but we'll be in it. If we don't win this one, it'll be problematic because the next 2 games after that are also tough ones for us. So Colorado needs to get their win now because they might go back on the schneid for the next 2 games after that, in which Colorado plays
I'm trying to remember, but
at Houston Dynamo.
They play Vancouver at home on June 2nd, and then away to Houston. And I think Vancouver is so up and down, they'll either blow us out or we'll blow them out.
Or it's going to be a Breck Shea special.
I was waiting for a Breck Shea joke. If you haven't seen Breck Shea miss this goal, or if you have seen it, right now, turn off this podcast and go watch Breck Shea blow this unbelievable chance that nobody should blow.
Mark, do you want to know what the X goals was on that individual opportunity?
1.0.
It was not 1.0.
0.75?
More.
0.9?
Less. Slightly less.
Wow.
0.88.
Which is as close to, like, 1 as it gets in expected goals. That was, like, inside 4 yards, wasn't it?
Yes, that was...
It's like, and it looked... Did he... I don't know. Let's leave this alone.
Okay, yes. Last thing that I'll say, folks, on that note, as far as specials are concerned, anytime Diego Valeri is standing over a ball, a corner, any kind of set piece, the Rapids are going to have to be organized and aware of themselves. So, you know, certainly can't have a repeat like we did in the final minutes against New England Revolution. Certainly can't have a situation like that second or third goal, I believe, against Real Salt Lake. The goalkeeper to however many people are on the wall, that communication, getting set up and being in the proper position is going to be absolutely key, because Diego Valeri will burn you. Moving on, Mark, as previously mentioned, I was at training this past Tuesday, so from Field 20. Marlon Harrison and Courtney Ford, Mark, can you guess where they have been this week?
Playing soccer.
They have been playing soccer with other people. Woo-hoo! And against other people.
Not Academy Boys.
Not Academy Boys, not doing training on the side, not just doing long passes or just running on the side, folks. Courtney Ford and Marlon Harrison are back into team training. As of today, they were training mostly with the second team, and they will be reevaluated, I assume, sometime tomorrow. Today, if you're listening on Thursday or on Friday, it's probably already happened in terms of evaluating their possibility. Hudson was optimistic about them for next week, but it's definitely played down them playing this week. I would put them as doubtful, if not certainly out, for this coming Saturday, but I would say very likely that for the first time in over 2 months for both players, Mark, that both of them will have a full week of training with the first team next week. That bodes well for them getting some minutes against Vancouver Whitecaps. Hudson did say that they were planning with some of the academy kids, if necessary, getting in a reserve scrimmage on Sunday for the players who don't play, and should Ford and Harrison not play a role at all in the game on Saturday, that they'll play on that. So they'll have, you know, effectively a simulated game, if you will, that'll be part of evaluating them in terms of their timeline for getting back with the team. Johan Blomberg has just been doing some running on the side and passing drills with small group teams, hasn't been a part of any scrimmages. His rehab continues, but is looking to be out for this coming Saturday. Skel Shangashi and Dominic Baji both had injury concerns over the last couple of weeks. Baji was feeling it a little bit against New York City FC with his hamstring, which is why he was subbed out a little bit earlier than planned. But all reports are is that he's totally fine. That won't be a problem. There might be a little bit of pain, but there's no concern for him hurting it anymore. And as Hudson said post-game after the New York Red Bulls loss, saying that it was precautionary, that they didn't want to, you know, he could have played on it, but they didn't want to risk losing him for a long time. They're past it at that point. It's just a function of, you know, can Baji physically stomach it in the 80th minute? And if not, can they get somebody else in there for him? Gashi's groin issue completely gone away at this point. The thing that Hudson said that he needs is more minutes. I would expect him to be available, Mark. I wouldn't be surprised if he started on Saturday and played in excess of 65 or 70 minutes. Hudson also said that Boley continues to progress, and that the next thing for him is more minutes, preferably a start and going well into the second half. Hudson said something really unique, Mark, and I was kind of picking up on this initially, where Nicholson was taking it a little bit easy in some trainings, and he indicated that in a scuffle, apparently, with Roger Espinosa in his Rapids debut, there was a little bit of an issue where he tweaked his back. Nicholson got an ejection earlier this week, and he'll be totally okay on that. I know there were also some concerns that he seemed to pull up with a little bit of some hamstring tightness against the New York Red Bulls, and again on Saturday as well. That looks to be okay as well. So Nicholson might be in a similar position to Baji, where not at risk of hurting anything further, but, you know, if at some point it's the 75th minute and he's feeling it in pain, you know, there's, at that point, he, for the sake of the team, needs to be done.
Did we see Blomberg back in training regularly?
No. Blomberg's been with the team, but he's done no team scrimmages whatsoever. He's done PT, running, and drills with them, but anytime the team's been doing 7v7 or 11v11, he's doing passing drills with the academy kids on the side or some other work with the trainer. Huh. So I would list Blomberg firmly as out for this Saturday.
And then the other question that came up this past, well, first is where Sam Hamilton playing, but the other one is, Nicky Jackson didn't appear on the U.S. Open Cup roster or the weekend roster for the switchbacks. The question that was asked to me on Twitter was, is he hurt? Have you seen Nicky Jackson in Commerce City?
Every single time. I can't remember the last training. I think the training immediately following the announcement that Nicky Jackson was loaned down to the switchbacks, I want to say that Tuesday. Whenever that was, I didn't see him, but other than that, I can't remember the last time I didn't see him, with the team. He's been training. I would say both him and Sam Hamilton have been fully participating in training. Neither of them have shown up late or sat any drills out or have left training any early. If Nicky Jackson is carrying a knock of any kind, he's not showing it and it's not limiting him in practice. And then I guess to answer, I think there was the first question of where are we seeing Sam Hamilton in training, Mark?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So, he's been, I'd have to go back and look, but folks, every single time I've noticed where he's been firmly with the, reserve team, usually, one of the center backs, and I believe usually he's been the left center back, so to the left of, Axel Schuberg and to the right of Kip Colvey, usually. So that's where he's been. You know, I know there were some conversations that he was a holding mid or, you know, shadowing Michael Azir or something. Hudson clearly sees him as a backup, to Tommy Smith in that left center back role, Mark. Any other questions from Field 20 at this point? Okay, I guess
I got mine in.
Okay, I guess the one other thing that I will say, folks, Hudson's been pretty clear. I know the listeners and the comment section on the Burgundy Wave will be rolling their eyes at this point of, you know, every single time Hudson's saying that Bowley really needed a preseason.
He's another week away.
Okay, Mark.
He's been another week away since early April.
Okay, well, Mark, guess the current week that we're in right now, guess which number of week this is for him being fully participating in training with the team.
How many weeks has he been fully participating?
Yes, as of this week, counting this week.
9?
This will be week number 7. Guess how long the Colorado Rapids preseason was leading up to MLS.
4?
7 weeks.
Oh, really?
Yes. If we go from the third week of January and then kicking off the first Saturday in March, folks. So at this point, as of next week, Yannick Bowley will have had as much time with the Rapids as the Rapids preseason was. And at this point, I don't think you can make any other excuses as far as him not having a proper off season. Okay, Mark, it is time to go to our favorite section of the podcast, Ask HTHL.
Woohoo! All right, we have a lot of Ask HTHLs. We're going to start we're going to go chronologically, if it's okay with you, Matthew.
Of course.
If I can call you Matthew. The earliest one or the farthest one back was one that we wanted to answer last week, and we just didn't get to it because we kind of forgot. Jared out in Utah asked HTHL, why did the Rapids have a U23 team? Shouldn't these potential college grads be getting first team minutes? When the Colorado Rapids start an over 40 team, holla at your boy. So this is a great question that I'm well equipped to answer because I've been following the U23s for years. The idea behind the U23 team is that they play in the USL-PDL. The USL-PDL is the amateur version, right? A USL first team is made up of predominantly or exclusively paid players. A USL PDL team is specifically not paid. And that's so that players who are NCAA college kids can play high-level soccer with other high-level college kid soccer, and it won't affect their NCAA eligibility, because not only can playing professional soccer affect your eligibility, but playing in a league with professionals could affect your eligibility. This is a problem that only exists in America. Other leagues don't have this kind of complicated problem of maintaining.
You just have a U23 reserve.
Exactly, and it doesn't matter whether you. So anyways, the U23s, it's almost a misnomer because the real, you know, most college kids are 22 and below. And U23s can technically go up to, I think, the age of 23. So the reality is that the vast majority of U23s for the Rapids are their college age players who are off in college at Stanford or at Oregon State or at Wake Forest, to name a couple places where current top level former academy players are playing, can come back, train together, and get high level instruction from the Rapids while potentially training with the first team. The other thing that happens is, of course, the regular season for the U18s, the U16s, and the U14s is the same as basically the school calendar. It's from September through May, and then the championship for the U18s is, I think, in June. So those guys can start up, and they can join together. So you can put a 16-year-old, an 18-year-old, two 21-year-olds, so on and so forth. The Rapids like to fill that team out with players from DU or CU or CSU who are playing at a high level, and they don't want to go home for the summer. And the Rapids is the best place to play. So, for instance, Andre Shinyashiki, who's a striker from Brazil for DU and a very talented one, is likely to be involved in the MLS draft in a year from now, is on this U23 team, and he's able to play at, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods. He's able to get high-level instruction from the Rapids coaching staff. He's able to get a look from the Colorado Rapids and from other teams that they play. And the last piece that goes with this, I think, is always interesting, is the U23s have also featured a couple players who were looking to hook on with a team and showcase their skills around the country with other folks. So last year there was a kid whose name escapes me, Greek name, Australian international. I know, right? I'll Google it afterwards. But he was he had bounced around to kind of second division lower league teams, and he was getting a tryout with the Rapids, and that's pretty common in U23s, that you'll get one or two guys who are trying to like catch somebody's eye at a higher level. So they're really, you know, Jared's asking, shouldn't these guys be playing somewhere better somewhere else? And the answer is
yes, they're playing at Oregon State and Stanford,
right.
And Wake Forest.
Who are off right now, and who because the NCAA, and if you don't know this, fans, you should familiarize yourself with a little bit about NCAA eventually, but the NCAA season is really short.
It's not gutting.
It's problematic for Major League Soccer, and it's too short because basically the season lasts from
it's basically a three-month tournament.
Yeah, it's from August to November, and a lot of teams are now doing spring
short seasons.
Yeah,
you just did it,
but they don't really count, and they're not the same level. But really, you know, the complaints have been levied for years that like a player like Court Ford goes from playing 90 days worth of high level, or even 120 days worth of high level soccer, to being expected to play 240 days of high level soccer. And most of these guys, their bodies just aren't ready for it. Their physiology isn't prepared for that kind of thing. And NCAA isn't doing any favors. But this is another topic for another time. Nonetheless, point being, the U23 is a great opportunity to stretch that season out, make those players get more physically fit, and introduce them to a higher level of training with professional instruction.
Retweet, Jared, as soon as I get any rumors or sniff whatsoever about the Rapids starting an over 40 team, I will point them directly to your agent to try and sign you as a free agent.
Okay, Matt, I'll throw the next one at you, which is Zing Leg Tubes. David Z is asking, this is a negative ask HTHL, but we've lost five in a row, so there's not much positive right now. Is Enzo cutting it? We all love his story, but he has the ball a lot. He doesn't seem to produce anything. Matt, is Enzo cutting it?
You've lost five in a row. The team's played very, very poorly. If I were suddenly made supreme dictator of Colorado Rapids Soccer Club, every single position at this point would be up for evaluation. Enzo does a number of things really good. He has probably one of the best defensive work rates on the team. He works harder than everybody. He's not afraid to provide some physicality in a midfield that, in my opinion, has been lacking a little bit of bite when it's needed. I would agree with Sing Leg Tubes that, as much as that energy is there, he's a little bit like, he, at times he's like a chicken with its head cut off, where that energy is good to have, but it's not necessarily directed in what's needed right now, and then includes some of his decisions going forward,
yeah,
and some of what he does offensively in possession. One of these days he's gonna hit a cracker from 40 yards and C38's gonna go crazy,
yeah,
but I agree that I think he's a, we need a number eight to, he is the center midfield equivalent of Dylan Serna on this team right now.
Yeah, I'll agree with everything you said and just add that the decision making in the instant is, it's not quite there yet, but you're so right. I mean, he's had so many plays. You and I probably both have the same feeling as he goes up for him, where you see him from 35 yards out, smack the ball, and you're like, yes, this is going to be it hit the crossbar. You know, like, it hits the tee. It just swings wide. Like, he's been so close, and we just need that moment. So the other thing I'll just add is, and this applies a lot with the Rapids, is like, should so-and-so start over so-and-so? Is so-and-so good enough to play on this team? The problem right now is probably that, like, nobody's good enough right now. Like, you can play the game where you say, like, the 11 we have on the field aren't good enough, and there's 11 other guys on this team, and they should start. And my feeling is probably, like, if we swap the entire, you know, top end of the roster for the bench and the reserves, my guess is that it would be equally as craptastic. Like right now, nobody's playing well, and nobody's earned a spot, and there's no evidence that anybody on the reserve roster is so magical that they'll just slot in and suddenly do incredible things. So, like, for midfield, it's like, yeah, maybe Enzo's not cutting it right now. Who else are we going to put in there? Blomberg, who doesn't get into position to get a lot of touches. He makes nice passes when he does, but he has very few touches, and his work rate's not super great, and his defensive work rate's kind of only so-so. Boateng, who feels to me is playing himself across the field in multiple different positions and playing him out of each position they try him at. Jack Price is the only guy in the midfield who you slot in every week and you say, like, yes, he will play, and he will play exactly the same role he always has. Everybody else, it's like, you know, we could roll the dice and put anybody out there. Eigner, Blomberg, Boateng, Enzo, Azira.
Rapids, man.
Gashi, Connor Casey, you know, Pablo Mastroeni. Like, and we probably won't get any better or worse production. All right. Next one up. Spencer Cutright. 5 straight losses, no tactical changes other than injury replacements. Based on player personnel already on the team, is the 3-5-2 the best option moving forward? What other formations could the Rapids use to be successful? So it's a great question. You know, I always say, and a lot of people say this, I'm stealing this idea from other brilliant pundits in the soccer world, formation is shorthand, right, for tactics. It doesn't mean everything, because as we've seen, as we've already mentioned, you know, Tommy Smith effectively, after the Rapids went down 1-0 against New York City, came up into the midfield as almost a second holding mid alongside Azira. And if you look at his average position, I put this in Backpass this week.
He's right next to Azira.
And that happens because that's a known tactical adjustment the Rapids are going to do, which effectively means that our 5-3-2 isn't really a 5-3-2 sometimes. It turns into a 4-2-3-1 or even like a 4-1-4-1 when the team wants it to look that way, and I'm sure they've coached it that way. That being said, it's a really good question as to whether we really have the right guys to pull off this formation. I think if the question is, if the desire of the Rapids is to show high soccer IQ, attacking prowess, and an offensive kind of look, then it's not a terrible idea to go to a 4-3-3. And the 4-3-3 will allow them to do some of the things you mentioned earlier on at the beginning of the podcast, which is play route one over the top, bomb it forward football. It also will allow some of our better players, like Skels and Gashi, who's a roaming left wing, or Marlon Hairston when he's, knock on wood, healthy, who's a natural potential finisher, to really be in their best positions. And to let those, the other piece that's been tricky for me with the 5-3-2 is that we've been pushing those wingers out to the wings, and we've been asking the three midfielders to kind of shuttle out to the wings to move the ball to them, which has meant that we've been playing very hard on the left or very hard on the right and ceding the middle to the opponent. And they can either drive through us like a knife through hot butter on the counter, like we saw against New York, or we just don't have the attack in the right place. Like, we're playing to wide, and we're not playing to zone 14 very well. So that's something that opening up into the 4-3-3 might afford you. Do I think it's ever going to happen? No. Matt, do you think another formation might help the Rapids at this point?
I've talked to a number of coaches at various levels who say that they always want to test things out and sort of have two modes they work on. But Greg Vanney had a really salient point when I interviewed him prior to leg one against CCL, saying that, you know, a good coach will have, you know, to your point about how, you know, tactics is, or about how formation is shorthand, you know, a good coach, the way that, you know, my team approaches the game is going to be the exact same. The formation just allows us to do it in different ways depending on the opponent. And we've seen Toronto, when healthy, they've been able to do it from a 4-4-2, from a 4-2-3-1, from a 3-5-2. I guess the real question for me is are the, you know, to the standpoint from a style of play, take formation out of your brain. Hudson wants to play out of the back. He wants to create offense. He wants to have attacking players going forward, starting central, go out wide, come back in. Are the Rapids doing that well? Right now, they're not doing that. I would say this question is almost a moot point because based on all of his previous jobs, you know, Hudson's a 3-5-2 guy. You know, you are, this is the equivalent of asking, you know, the head coach at Army football who runs the triple option to switch to the spread offense.
Totally.
This is, you know, this is his formation. He's going to live and die by
right.
it. You know, could they change things? I will say that tactically, in the sense of having two formations to allow you to sort of switch gears, that's kind of built in, because I've been having a number of conversations, at times borderline arguments, with a couple members of the Rapids press corps of, is this really a 3-5-2 or is this really a 5-3-2? Does it vary from game to game?
I was going to talk about next, which is, like, it's hard to say for me, and I'm learning, and I'm very, and this is an argument I've seen on and offline, if they're even different, because the reality is one of them is what the formation looks like when you're in attack, mm-hmm. and one of them is what the formation looks like when you're in defense, right? No one's going to play the quote-unquote 3-5-2 and say, what that really means is when we're defending, we're actually going to keep our wingers higher, because that'd be suicide, right?
Yeah.
But there are a couple different ways you can make your 5-3-2 look, which is to say you can push Enzo Martinez and Jack Price back as kind of dual defensive midfielders that are really trying to mark.
You can flip the center three independent of what the wingbacks are doing.
Well, what I was going to say was you can say that you're really, really interested in playing in ignoring the wings and playing tight to the middle and denying everything into the middle. Or you can push the middle three midfielders up a little bit and say, we just want a tight five-man back line that won't concede crosses or the wings. So that's the only difference I see in defense. In attack, there are about a million permutations of how it can look, and we've seen a couple of them.
We could do a whole episode on that.
Right, but for me, like, when people say, is it a 3-5-2 or a 5-3-2, it's...
Are the Rapids on the road and playing for a draw, or are the Rapids at home and trying to win?
Right.
That is my response to that question.
Right, another way of saying this, are we ahead or are we behind? Another way of saying that is, are we man-marking? Another way of saying that is, are we trying to play wide or are we trying to play narrow? So there are a lot of permutations to it, and there's no way of saying, like, well, the Rapids really play a 5-3-2. Like, I think that would be... And, you know, if you're a tactical genius or you have your A license, feel free to call us or email us and tell me that I'm an idiot. But my sense of things is saying it's one versus the other.
If you're focused on that argument, you're not seeing the forest through the trees.
Yeah, yeah. It's just if you're playing Subeteo, I don't know how to pronounce that game, or you're playing foosball, right? You see the pieces move in an extremely narrow, linear way. You're seeing checkers and not chess.
Yes.
So, not to be pedantic or insulting to our brilliant listeners, who are obviously far more nuanced and complicated than that. All right.
I hope we answered your question, Spencer.
Of course we did. We answer all these questions. Brian Wendland asks a really good question, which is, as most of these questions tend to be, their own podcasts, articles, or books post-mortem of the end of the season by themselves. He asked, a lot of the frustration from fans is directed at Hudson. Should any be thrown Porrick Smith's way? How much time does he deserve to get the front office right? And those are great questions. So just to remind us, Porrick Smith started with the Rapids at the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015. And
he didn't become general manager until this past year, and he was interim general manager right. until January.
Right. And, you know, like, you can kind of see, if you want to look at 3 years of Rapids acquisitions, you can see a very clear shift. At the beginning of his tenure, Colorado was still buying a lot of dribbly Argentinians.
Yep.
Because, Claudio Lopez was still on the payroll, and none of those guys panned out. At the end of his tenure, or when Lopez was gone and when Porrick came on as a full-timer, you see a lot more players out of the English Championship and the Scottish League and of Scandinavia. And that's, I'm being really blunt, but that's really very noticeable. So the question becomes, how long does he get? And that's a really good question. But the better piece, the first is, how much responsibility? I think a lot. I mean, I'd say it's 50-50, you know, like, we are constantly talking in the last 5 weeks of whether the coach isn't putting the team on the field in a position to succeed, or whether he's not picking the best 11 that the Rapids actually have, or whether the Rapids don't have 11 players who are talented enough to play at an MLS level. When you've got guys like Declan Wynn, when Edgar Castillo is not producing much in the offense, when Enzo Martinez isn't passing super well, when we've got a grab bag of underneath strikers who are disappointing equally from week to week, from Yannick Bolli to Joe Mason to Jack McBean, you none of that is on Hudson, who wasn't around to make those decisions. Those were Porrick Smith and the front office's decisions. The one thing I'll add to that, and it's not excusing, it's possibly explaining, those of us who were with the Rapids through the offseason, we're paying very close attention to all the rumors about acquisitions, know that they were rumored and then missed on multiple players, one after another. And having been with this team and followed the front office machinations for 3.5 years, one of the things that you'll hear, you know, we missed on Alan Pulido, we missed on Alejandro Bedoya, we missed on a number of players. There is always a, you know, bullseye, can't miss, best possible option for Colorado, and they fall short, and instead of getting the 10, they get the 8 or the 7 in terms of the dart board, you know, like the points in the bullseye. Like, they don't get the guy, and that, you can chalk that up to a couple things. If you want to be harsh, you can chalk it up to the front office failing. If you want to be felicitous, you say every team gets jerked around by players who, you know, are playing them for a fiddle, you know, like Alan Pulido using the Rapids to try and get a really nice deal with Chivas, you know? And then you get in somewhere in the middle, which is, you know, the Rapids are going to miss sometimes, and not everybody's going to pan out. But the problem is, we're not LA, we can't get a Zlatan. We're not New York, we can't get David Villa. We're Colorado, you know, for better or for worse. Most of America thinks of us as flyover country, and most people in Europe have never heard of Colorado. They probably can't even pronounce it right. And that's a liability that we are always going to be stuck with, you know? And until something magical changes, like we appoint Arsene Wenger to be our GM, that's just a reality that this team has to deal with. So I'll lay some responsibility on the front office, but only some.
The one thing I'll add to that, Mark, I had a really good conversation with Porrick during the offseason, talking really big picture stuff about the Rapids way and the evolution, all that stuff. And everything that he said, this was a couple weeks after Hudson had gotten appointed. I want to say this was right before the reentry draft when the Rapids picked up Jack McBean from the Galaxy. And every question that I asked, whether it was directed at, you know, why Anthony Hudson or what does he bring to it, ultimately came back to him in some aspect. The Rapids took a very long time in their coaching search, Mark. If rumors are to be believed, and if we're assuming they did their due diligence, they interviewed a number of possible domestic candidates with various levels of MLS and U.S. soccer experience. If rumors are to be believed, they were looking at options in Europe. They were looking at options potentially south of the border with Liga MX experience. Mm-hmm. And everything that I said made it pretty clear to me, Hudson was Porik's guy. This was the guy that he found from an ideology standpoint, from a plan standpoint, from everything that they were thinking tactically and how they wanted to adopt analytics and what they wanted to bring the team, vision, details on the pitch, off the pitch. These two are tied at the hip. There is no doubt in my mind that in going through all the possible candidates the Rapids had and realistically the ones that they were looking for, that Anthony Hudson was Porik Smith's man. And if Hudson ultimately is a failure in MLS, then some of that has to be steeped on Smith choosing him over a player who had some understanding of football in North America and certainly some prior Major League Soccer experience.
And I think the question or the point that can be added to that is you, Brian asked, how long does the FO have to get this right? And the answer is, I think any coach needs 2 years, period.
I would agree.
I'm just, unless they're curt and awful incompetent, which is, you know, should be an Urban Dictionary term by itself, curt and awful incompetent, then they should get 2 years. The thing that I'll add is that potentially if Colorado at the end of 2019 is terrible, after a terrible 2018, hypothetically speaking, a terrible 2018 season,
then I think you have grounds for both Smith and Hudson being dismissed.
Read my mind. Exactly what I was going to say. Matt, you take this one first. Matthew Cleveland asked, I think it's your first time writing in, so thanks, Matthew. Hudson seems set in his ways with player selection and style of play. If he's not going to change, what is the ceiling for this group? It doesn't seem like we are always on the same page, so if that improves, maybe we'll get some ties instead of just some elves. Hashtag Free Agner. So what do you think the ceiling is for this team if there's no major transfers at the transfer window? Like, how many wins? How many losses? Can we make the playoffs? Is this a growing year? Are we just kind of holding till 2019? Like, what's the best circumstances with this club?
I think this is definitely a rebuild. This is a Hudson getting used to the league, Hudson getting the team used to him, and at least something that I've been thinking about a lot, especially with the 1 year contracts and the loan deals that they've had, taking a couple flyers on a couple of players and seeing if they can work out. I don't think if the team ends up missing the playoffs, I don't think anybody in the front office is panicking or thinking burn it all down. To answer Matt's question directly, I think, you know, what is the ceiling for this team? I think firing on all cylinders, executing Hudson's team based on the talent they have on paper and what we've seen, especially from the forwards, I think this is that gritty fifth or sixth playoff seed team that if they get hot at the right time, I wouldn't say that they're a giant killer, but they're a team that Sporting Kansas City isn't going to want to play in a two-leg series, in the sense that they know they're going to have to come to altitude, it's potentially going to be cold, and they're going to go there for whenever the away leg is for the Rapids, and they're going to muck it up defensively. I think the peak for this team is probably what the regression to the mean is for the 2016 team in a vacuum. That 2016 Rapids team overachieved in a number of ways, but if you don't have the Mark Birch, Sam Cronin trade, Pablo Mascherani is able to figure things out, then I think that's a gritty fifth or sixth seed team that's not going to be a contender, could consistently make the playoffs for 2 to 3 teams, and if they get hot at the right time, or if they're, you know, physical, they might not be able to beat a Seattle Sounders over 180 minutes, but they're definitely going to take a bite out of them on the way. Yep. I think that's the ceiling for this team. And wasn't there a follow-up question?
No,
about player selection?
He did. I'll just add that here's an interesting thought experiment for Matthew or for any other listeners. If you're bored, go back a couple years. Especially if you're a longtime Rapids fan and you follow the team for a while, go back to any MLS Match Center game from 3 or 4 years ago, or go back in whatever files that you have of starting lineups, and find an early season starting lineup from a team in 2012 or 2013, and then compare it to an end of season lineup, and you'll find some really funny things. You'll find things like the Colorado Rapids started Carlos Alvarez, who, you know, 2 years later was basically completely out of professional football. Or Danny Muwanga was the opening day starting striker for the Colorado Rapids.
Nick LaBrocca being a regular for this team.
You were reading my mind tonight. Nick LaBrocca was the regular D-mid, you know, for the Colorado Rapids. And I actually liked Nick, but he had a lot of liabilities as a player. But, like, if you look at the early season, Davey Armstrong from who's now down in the Springs, or used to be down in the Springs. You get players who you look back and you go, wow, looking back, they were not good enough to play for this team. That's the question that you kind of ask with this team right now, and questions about ceiling and players, which is like, later on this season, will we look back and say, wow, I can't believe Hudson thought that starting 11 was really good enough to be an MLS starting 11. So, you know, it's a good point. All right, Matt, you take this one too. For starters, it's a great one from Jeff Casimir, our old friend. What's the one thing that would most lift your spirits this weekend?
A win, regardless of context or how it happens.
Yeah.
If I were to expand on that, I guess I would just say, you know, at this point on an individual basis, the team's struggling, you know, something's going to have to happen, you know, something's going to have to come up out of the blue, somebody's going to have to rise up, you know, other than Dominic Baggi, I feel like this team on multiple levels has been really, really impotent. You know, we've been knocking or criticizing Enzo in this episode for what he does in possession. Enzo hit one of those 40-yard bombs. Boateng actually be a right wing back instead of a center mid masquerading as that. Danny Wilson, Tommy Smith, show me something. Tim Howard, pull out a Belgium game. You know, somebody step up and say, this isn't good enough anymore. This team is bleeding. I am going to do everything in my individual power, independent of the bile rising around me, to stop this bleeding.
I'd like to say on that note, I'd like one of these players to shut me up. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like me and you and basically the entire writer punditocracy, like we write and we've written mildly critical things, but we're still fans, so we want to be behind the team. And then the next week it goes badly and we write something a little bit more critical. And the week after that it's a little bit more critical. And you start to get to the point where you're like, God, I kind of don't want to see these guys in the hallway and assume that they've read my writing and be like, oh yeah, pencil neck, why don't you go out there and just see if you can run for, you know, like, I would...
Declan Wynn, score a hat trick, and I will totally be okay with you giving some obscene visual gesture towards the press box specifically pointed at me.
And I think they know that on some... Maybe they don't really know that, but I think on some level they know that, like, if they get criticized by the press, it's because we see the same things that pretty much everybody else sees, which is that it's not good enough, and they want to be better too. And I would love it if they would just, you know, if Tim Howard would stand on his head and say, oh, I look like a statue, huh? Right, like, I would be fine with that, you know? If you've ever stood close to Tim Howard, though, you probably don't want him yelling at you because he's terrifying. Like, I could full-blown see him eat a small child in front of me. It could happen. It could absolutely happen. So I would like them to shut me up beyond the wins thing. The other thing I was thinking, I don't know where this thought came from, but I keep seeing ads for Lunazul, and we've talked about this, but short of winning, I would like to try Lunazul and find out that it's actually a pretty good tequila. That's, I think, you know, in my head also. Like, that would lift my spirits. Maybe I was thinking of the word spirits too literally there. I don't know. Last one for the night, and then we'll either call it a night, or Matt, you'll tell me whether we want to tack on an interview here or push it to the next week. We have Matt's got a really good interview. We'll break up into two parts, and we'll see where the timing is on this. May have to wait till next week. Rick A. Ramos, I think, also maybe a first-time write-in. With an open DP slot, who would be your dream DP? Who would be your dream DP? Think ridiculous, Matt. And then we're also, you know, going with a realistic
dream DP, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah.
Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi, put them in the middle, have them be the number 10, we'll score 4 goals a game, and then it doesn't matter what the defense is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I'd like Leon Goretzka or N'Golo Kante or some other ridiculously...
wasn't there a hashtag on the end of this?
Casemiro. Marco Fabian.
Marco Fabian? Okay.
Who's Mexican player, right?
I'd take Marco Fabian right now.
So, Matt, do you have a realistic DP?
No, simply because as we addressed last week, 2 weeks ago now, doing our economics review of the Rapid situation, I think they're more likely to spend, I think they're more likely to go fully into the discretionary TAM before they sign another DP. This is a conversation for another time or maybe a follow-up Ask HTHO. There's a few financial benefits to being one of the few teams in MLS not using all three of their DP slots. Gashi being on the books this season, Mark, was from back when he signed his DP contract. So is Tim Howard. We don't really know in the post-TAM era what the Rapids are willing to spend from a GAM perspective on a DP. And they've already invested so much GAM in either other assets or other players. You know, the press release on Danny Wilson and Tommy Smith, who combined have a total compensation of over $1 million. USD. So in theory, they're all on GAM. So I don't know how much from a budget standpoint, you know, if this is the FIFA marker in terms of can I adjust it so I have more wage bill a week or I have more transfer window, it's almost like I've got two tickers and there's just so much that's been spent on the GAM ticker that I don't know if there's enough for me to go out and get a DP rather than just adjusting the TAM ticker and going out and getting another TAM level player.
Yep. I'm going to give you three names. Who asked this one? Matthew or
This was Rick Ramos.
Rick. So I have three names and I'm not being original. I'm regurgitating an article I wrote a year ago because I want any one of these guys. So Hakim Ziyech, he'll be crazy expensive because he plays for Ajax. He's rumored to, he wants out of Ajax. He probably wants to go to a bigger league. But I think when you go from the Dutch league, potentially you can go to MLS and command a big price, especially if you've been good. He's an international from Morocco. So he'll be starring at the World Cup this summer, and he'll potentially be doing some really, really good things. Another player who I really like who did make a transfer last season, and I don't know that he got a lot of run this year. I think he's with either Pachuca or another team in Liga MX is a guy named Alejandro Chumacero. He was a leading scorer in Copa Libertadores in 17-18. He played for a Bolivian team called The Strongest, which is just an awesome name by itself. And he had 53 goals. He's 5'4". He's exactly that dribbly, crazy Maxi Morales, Giovinco, you know.
Jao Plata.
Yeah, like he can pop up anywhere. He plays kind of a number 10 or a roaming, you know, 7 or 9. So he's super fun. And then the last guy who's on here is, it'd be nice to get another Swedish player up on this team, John Guidetti, who has been at Celta Vigo and he's only 26 years old. He's been kind of buried in you know, Celta Vigo is a mid-table La Liga team. I feel like why be mid-table La Liga when you could star in Major League Soccer? And he's a striker. So I know that we spent a lot of money on a bunch of different strikers and whatever, but like, what the hell, man? We've got a DP slot. Let's go and use it. You know, Matt's right that, like, it's unlikely we're going to use that. We get extra TAM money if we don't use the...
Get extra GAM if you don't use it.
Sorry, my bad. My bad. My use... I thought I was the resident Rapids expert on the really complicated financials and acronyms, and then Matt comes along, and he's actually, like, got a math science brain, and he can actually... He's got a good memory, too, and he drinks less before the podcast, so... He can know. But anyways, John Guidetti is a really talented striker, and I would like him. Those are theoretically more realistic because they're not, you know, the top flight ridiculous things. But the last thing I'll say is this, and we'll probably talk more about it because there'll be so many fun transfer rumors during the World Cup. But, you know, the World Cup is this crazy time when players salary potential and transfer fees get massively inflated because they do one thing. I mean, James Rodriguez had a ridiculous goal in the 2014 World Cup and spun it into a giant contract with Real Madrid and then basically did nothing for Real Madrid. He came off the bench, he scored some goals, but, like, he wasn't really the guy. And now he's with Bayern, and he's doing a little bit better, but he's not the guy. Like, he's not, like, I think people thought James was going to be the next great player. He was going to win Ballon d'Or, and he hasn't.
Chicharito's going to score one goal for Elche this summer, and then immediately whatever offering fee potentially that West Ham's dealing with is immediately going to double, just because of that.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Or David De Gea will do amazing. I mean, David De Gea already is probably one of the best, but, like, you know, Germany's going to have, it looks like Manuel Neuer's not going to probably play.
Mm-hmm.
Or if he does, it'll be, you know, kind of in a reserve role because he hasn't been healthy and starting this year. Whoever Germany is going to start as their starting goalkeeper is going to be ridiculous. And his transfer fee, you know, rumors are just going to go through the roof. So just keep an eye out for that. It'd be super fun. And watch the Rapids, you know, like, scoop somebody up on the rebound or do something on the down low while everybody else is making noise with World Cup heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be a good time, speaking of teams, like, the two teams in MLS most likely to make a ridiculous overpriced buy, I would say, are Atlanta and Seattle. Because Seattle needs something right now, and Atlanta just likes to spend money no matter
I also think there's a real possibility that Atlanta doesn't get out of the summer transfer window with their current core intact.
Well, there's that.
I think there's a real possibility that either they get an offer for Miguel Almiron or Joseph Martinez that they, just based on the number, cannot say no to. And then that'll mean that they'll be reinvesting that into some new attacking piece, probably.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you ever want a simple answer, never ask us a transfer-based question, because both of us, you know, either play enough FIFA or Football Manager or watch enough foreign soccer that we have our eye on this player and that player, and we like that guy and this guy. And, like, you know, like, I'm watching, you're a championship EPL guy as your other leagues besides MLS, and my other leagues are USL and Bundesliga. So, like, there's always, like, some left back for some German team that I'm like, oh, he would be the best. You know, like, and I'm sure you've got a guy in the championship.
I mean, if Fulham wins this Saturday, Ryan Sessegnon will be the best 18-year-old in the Premier League next year, bar none. And eventually Fulham's going to sell him and be able to buy another Craven Cottage. Like at some point, Ryan Sessegnon is going to make a move to Tottenham or Man U or Liverpool or something, and that transfer fee alone will pay for the redevelopment of Craven Cottage on its own.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, Ryan Sessegnon at like 32 in MLS, like he is Sebastian Blanco on roids.
The Southampton plan, which is we're going to be the academy for every other team, the feeder team for every other team in the English Premier League.
Yes. Okay, Mark, this is pushing over almost 90 minutes, so it's been a really good episode in terms of us being energized and angry, and I think is going to empower the Rapids fans who will be attending the game on Dick's Sporting Goods Park. So I think we will hold off. We'll continue to tease the Skelch and Gashi sit down, and hopefully we'll have some very good vibes from Mr. Gashi next week as we discuss the Rapids defeating the Portland Timbers in epic and dramatic fashion. Listeners, we'll see you next week.